Hi, I'm Jason Stein, publisher of Automotive News. We'll get to the latest episode of Daily Drive in a minute, but I'm hoping you'll spend a few minutes taking our Daily Drive listener survey. We can't thank you enough for listening and want to know more about you, your listening habits, and any other feedback you may have for the program. The survey will take less than 2 minutes to finish and is completely anonymous. So please, visit autonews.com/DDSurvey and take the survey today. And as always, thank you for listening to Daily Drive.
Daily Drive is brought to you by Reynolds & Reynolds. Want to know how dealerships like yours saw increased profit performance dealership-wide? Visit reyrey.com/KPI to read the Impact on Profitability Study. That's reyrey.com/KPI.
I'm Jason Stein, publisher of Automotive News, and this is Daily Drive. It's Wednesday, September 23rd. If we take a look into the post-COVID crystal ball, what do we see? Will cars be sold the same way? Will partners find new avenues to come together? And will corporations find more reasons to share the cost of emerging technologies? All of these statements could be true. John Casessa, Senior Managing Director at financial services company Guggenheim Partners, sees a very different automotive space going forward, perhaps one that was destined to take shape in its current form. He believes the growing number of new players with an enormous amount of capital will help push the business case for electrification, but warns the frenzy may not last. Those industry partnerships that have taken hold of late make a lot of sense, he says, but excess capital for new players could create a shakeup along the way. These are just a few of the industry trends he's considering as we look at a new world, one that is taking shape before our own eyes. A frequent contributor to Automotive News over the years and a recent World Congress speaker, John's macro view is dynamic, detailed, and perhaps very different than what you might think. We've reached John Casessa near New York City. John Casessa, good to talk to you.
Good morning, Jason. Great to be on with you.
So, John, if we step back in time about 5 months or so, you were one of the first guests that we had on our World Congress conversations a lifetime ago. I'd like to know your thoughts on how the industry has adapted over the course of the last 6 months. What's changed for you most significantly?
Well, I think, notwithstanding all the uncertainty that still exists around COVID, the economy, world trade, all that stuff, the industry has adapted remarkably. And I think of a couple of things. You know, first of all, the industry's back up and running around the world. So manufacturing parts and cars, and of course, the tremendous complexity in good times, but it's much harder in bad times. And I think about companies like Lear or GM who rapidly developed processes and procedures to safely get back to work and make a lot of stuff. So that is, one of these. It's almost reminiscent of the sort of the can-do kind of spirit that, you know, you saw in the arsenal of democracy. So that's been a remarkable adaptation, and the industry's been filling a pipeline of pent-up demand, right, because people couldn't get out to buy cars for 3 months. I think the second thing that's very striking to me is how the franchise dealer network adapted. In almost in one fell swoop, they went omni-channel. This is, I guess, in the under the category of necessity is the mother of invention. So they learned to sell new vehicles online, and the customer learned to buy new vehicles online. Not that it wasn't happening, but when it became the only way to transact, people found a way to make it happen. And I think many dealers also discovered through this process that they could sell more cars at lower expense than they had before COVID. So I think, you know, many examples of adaptation, but I very much think of manufacturing recovery and the agility of the dealer body.
You and I had talked quite regularly prior to COVID-19 about the adjustment that the industry needed to make in order to realize a better return on capital. And you talked about the revolution that was going to take shape. How has COVID changed your thinking on what the industry needs to do moving forward?
Well, I think that idea of the revolution is based on technology change, and it's pretty clear that in our world, the technology changes that the product we make, the car, the truck, the bus, is becoming electric, connected, and intelligent. And so, you know, the argument would be that the things that help customers select a vehicle may change, you know, may have to do more with connectivity or the ability to find the digitized curb to drop off a package. And so COVID, you know, probably has done a couple things. You know, in the short term, it's led some people to say, boy, I need to own a car because I don't want to get on a bus or a subway. So that's probably good in the short term. On the other hand, you know, cities that all of a sudden had less traffic started to devote more of the streets to pedestrians, the bicycles, the restaurants, certainly true in New York, but not just New York, in Shanghai, in Milan. And so, you know, it does seem like COVID will accelerate some of the urban restrictions and regulations for vehicles. So I think it's been really very topsy-turvy and a little bit of both. I think also, you know, as to the earlier question, COVID has forced customers to go online to do business. And so it's gotten the industry to much more rapidly develop a direct sales model. I don't mean without the dealer, but I mean, you know, a virtual sales model, I should say.
And what else has emerged has been the enormous amount of capital that's been deployed for these EV companies. Can you talk a little bit about what you've seen just in terms of the access to capital and what's happening in that space?
Sure, that's a really important trend, Jason. I'm glad you brought it up. I think you could argue that, you know, COVID compelled the Fed to keep rates very low and, you know, and with all that money out there, because we pumped a lot of money to the economy, that's enabled companies that were previously starved of capital to go public through reverse IPOs, essentially to merge into a SPAC, special purpose acquisition company, and become public, and in one fell swoop rather than the long process to do an IPO. And so, you know, all that money out there, probably in part because of COVID, has caused an enormous amount of capital to flow to these new entrants. Obviously, Tesla, you know, it's got an enormous valuation, but Nikola and Workhorse and Lordstown, and they're coming every day. So for the incumbents, there is a reality that there are many new competitors, and they now have capital. And even if their business models in the long run could be flawed, too soon to tell, with capital they can try, do a lot of things that they might not otherwise be able to do. Put up factories, you know, create direct-to-consumer sales models. And I guess I'd sum up by saying you could argue that COVID has accelerated the impact of electrification. And electrification, I guess, is, in my view, is not just a technology change, different kind of propulsion system, but it's a business model change because electric cars are easier to make, so it lowers the barriers to entry for new companies. And new companies can more easily do things that incumbents have trouble with, you know, selling direct to the consumer or, you know, doing contract manufacturing. So I do think to your point, COVID has accelerated one of the big secular changes in the industry.
And I've got to believe that while these companies have been established or are establishing their footprint, there will be a shakeout to some extent in terms of survival, right? Because access to capital now is allowing these companies to at least bloom. But as we've seen in other markets, you and I have talked about China before, there's going to be a slimming down of the players at some point, right? There has to be a natural consolidation.
Absolutely. And I think we talked about this a little bit, you know, during the World Congress. This would be, by historical standards, we would call this the sort of the frenzy phase of a, you know, technological revolution. You know, first phase is when people invent stuff. And the second phase is when investors realize that this stuff's going to have a lot of growth, you know, the Model T or, you know, railroads, things like that. And so money piles in. And that is what's happening right now. I mean, this is money is piling in to these new companies. There's a frenzy. And inevitably, in these frenzies, and again, whether it's railroads or, you know, fiber optics or automobiles in the 20s, the market overshoots. Too much capital eventually flows in, and then there's a shakeout, because capital doesn't always stay free and available. And so I think, you know, that's the definition of a bubble, and I think that's very probably what's happening here, you know, almost certainly what's happening here. The question as to how long it takes and when the bubble bursts, hard to know. But in the end, you can only sell so many cars, and cost is very important, and scale is very important. So there will have to be a shakeout. So we're in the frenzy, and one would expect the bubble to pop at some point, and there will be great new companies that come out of this. There will be the incumbents that have sort of changed their stripes and are participating, and there'll probably be, you know, some combination of incumbents and the new entrants that, you know, create the next model, you know, sort of bricks and clicks in retail, for example.
Speaking of bricks and clicks in retail, Carvana. I would love to know your take on what's happened there and the rocket ride up that stock has taken over the course of the summer. And not only that, but the fact that they seem to be on a pathway to prosperity.
Yeah, well, the market is, you know, is putting an enormous value on Carvana, at $28.5 billion today. And I think, you know, one of the inferences from that is that this company, and CarMax has done this too, has found a way to use technology to tap into a giant untapped market, which is the market for private sale of used vehicles. And you probably know the used vehicle is much larger than the new vehicle market, and most of the used vehicle transactions are among private individuals. Well, through the technology CarMax and Carvana are using to photograph cars and to you know, to assess damages and you know, using artificial intelligence and machine learning to, you know, pinpoint trouble spots, you know, they're now able to buy cars unseen, and they're creating a liquid market for private individuals to sell and buy cars. So I think it's really a technology change that they've harnessed that is giving consumers options that didn't exist before. And so it's to me another example of the technological revolution. And the valuations, I think, reflect the fact that this market right now is still incredibly fragmented. Carvana, CarMax account for a tiny percentage of used car transactions. So I think investors are projecting that their share will go up. And, you know, even if it goes up 10 or 15%, that would, you know, multiply the size of these companies.
John, given your time in Detroit, could you ever have envisioned a day when I would have told you that Honda and General Motors were going to work on projects together in an incredibly meaningful way, platforms, other co-development? I mean, this is such a non-Detroit thing, right?
Well, Jason, I would not want to go back and look at all the forecasts that I've made and how wrong they've been. But I've gotten this one wrong, in part because, you know, Honda is a remarkably independent company. You could argue that Toyota is consolidating little by little the entire Japanese industry, except Toyota and Honda. And so I think what is happening here, to have two companies that are sort of vastly different histories and cultures, I think it is a reflection that the existing business model, the ICE business model, so to speak, is mature. It is technologically mature, and the markets are saturated in the markets for internal combustion engine vehicles. And so when that happens, when you reach maturity, imagine that, you know, that S-curve sort of flattening out at the top, then and you have too many players, then it becomes about cost, because you'll have excess capacity, and it becomes about cost, and then you get strange bedfellows when there's this kind of consolidation. Because the reality is, you can't consolidate or partner with anybody. It's who's willing and who's available. So I think, you know, probably unique circumstances had led to, you know, these kinds of partnerships. But I think from an economic theory standpoint, it does make a lot of sense. You know, GM is awfully good at big vehicles, and Honda's nowhere. And Honda's, you know, terrific at smaller unibody vehicles. And the cost of developing new technologies like electrification is, you know, too much for even the biggest companies. So it is the unimaginable, but, you know, in retrospect, it seems like it's rational, and one would expect more of those kinds of announcements.
Speaking of Detroit, there's something happening in the, you know, in the background that during COVID nobody's really talked about, but we certainly talked about it before COVID, and that's the merger of PSA and FCA. And I'm wondering whether now you think that that approach was absolutely the most correct, and what do you expect to come out of it?
Well, I think it's very hard to be absolute about any of these things, but I think the PSA-FCA merger, you know, is essentially analogous to the GM-Honda partnership we're talking about, and you know, except this is companies coming together, you know, permanently in exchange of value. And I think it's the same kind of challenge, that the market for, you know, the core products is mature, it's saturated, the technology is mature, and it costs a lot of money to create the new stuff. So, you know, whether it's GM and Honda or it's PSA or FCA, every automaker is facing this challenge of having enough capital to do a dual transformation. What I mean by that is to optimize the core business so it keeps making a lot of money for as long as possible while investing in the new business. And not just because for a regulatory reason, but because there are new growth areas that you want to participate in. So that takes a lot of capital. I mean, for one set of technologies to replace another, to change the product, the infrastructure, and whether it's PSA or FCA or Honda or GM or others, it's almost no one can do it alone.
Yeah, agreed. What are you looking for or what are you looking at in the remainder of the year and into next year? Where's your focus on this industry right now?
Yeah, I would say from a cyclical standpoint, you know, it's very much on, you know, the things, the economic indicators that drive auto demand. And the biggies are employment, how many people employed, the growth rate in disposable income, how much money are these people making, and then finally, consumer sentiment. And so if you said to me, just what's the one thing you're most watching from a cyclical standpoint, it's the Michigan Index of Consumer Sentiment. That had been on the Michigan scale, like close to 100 for many years, and we were doing 16 to 17 million more vehicles a year in the U.S. You know, right now it's in the low 70s. It has recovered a bit off the bottom, but it shows a great deal of caution. So I'd say, you know, near term, we're looking at employment, household incomes, and sentiment, because we don't yet know the full effect, the long-term effect of COVID, what that's had, you know, on consumers' ability to buy cars. And then I would say longer term, you know, a lot of the focus is on this idea of the incumbents and new entrants adjusting their business models, incumbents making choices to get out of businesses that they can't win in or partnering with other people. And eventually these new entrants who so far have gone, you know, their own way because they have a lot of access to capital, you know, they'll face that they are reckoning too, where you know, they're probably going to need help. And so I would be looking longer term for the, you know, for signs that these worlds are converging. And it you know, would not be a surprise for it to happen because if you go back and look at history in every other industry, it's eventually there's some convergence to create the new thing.
You'll be watching it. We'll be watching it. John, thanks so much for your thoughts, and thanks for being on Daily Drive.
Thanks, Jason. Great to speak with you.
We've reached John Casessa near New York City. And that's Daily Drive for Wednesday, September 23rd. For breaking news, go to autonews.com. And for a library of more than 125 interviews, go to autonews.com/dailydrive. We'll be back Thursday. Now, a word from our sponsor.
In today's automotive market, maximizing existing profit centers and creating new ones is more than a savvy move. It's the biggest factor in getting the most out of every customer opportunity. What would it mean to improve your profit performance in every area of your dealership? More customer pay ROs, more finance gross from new and used vehicles, fewer write-offs in service, reduced time required to complete a deal. The key to all of that, and more, is giving your employees the freedom to drive revenue. Time they spend focused on manual processes is time that can, and should, be used in more profitable ways. When this happens, processes are redefined, employees are empowered, and attention can be turned back to the customer. It all adds up to your dealership becoming the best version of itself. The big question is, how much more do you stand to make? How would a 44.3% increase in service department gross affect you? What about a 25.7% increase in combined gross per new vehicle sold? Those aren't theoretical figures. They are real key performance indicators from a 3-year study of dealerships who gave their employees that freedom to do more with their time. With the right tools behind your revenue drivers, you'll see improved profit performance too. To see more key performance indicators from real dealerships like yours, visit reyrey.com/KPI and read the full Impact on Profitability report. That's reyrey.com/KPI.